happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're simulcasting today on WPFW in Washington, D.C., WBAI, 37 and a half years I've been on in New York City, and of course, radio stations all across the United States, and people listening all over the world. Today, you talk about a packed show. No guest, because I have so many commentaries. Some I've written myself yesterday when I was thinking about the way the world is and what we should do to challenge it. Others, including Chris Hedges. Let's get this class war started from Truthdig. We're also going to look in our environmental segment today at huge good news about genetically modified organisms from ocean robins. Then small farms, not Monsanto, are the keys to global food security, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, Doug Sherman. I'll share that with you. New York City Mayor Bloomberg wants to force residents to vaccinate children under five. All right. But maybe the mayor is not aware of all of the science that he has been told supports that, and it doesn't. So we're going to address that. What the cancer industry does not want you to know about chemotherapy and radiation. This will be a really strong report from a researcher. I thought it was, after reading it, based on my own research, it is accurate. Dave Milovic. I'll share that with you. Families with kids go homeless as U.S. rents exceed their pay on the economy. Also, the case for universal health care. That's what I believe that any responsible country does. And indeed, over 30 countries do that. They have much better health care. It does not bankrupt them. All the lies and myths. And yet, we are engaged in nothing but lies and myths with Obamacare. I'll explain that. And what happens when we just lose our sense of who we are as a nation? And all we do is look at the efficiency of our beliefs. In effect, a lethal confidence. The empire of the senseless, Jeffrey St. Clair. We have a lot to share. Let's get started. Always on the latest on health and healing. Hot chocolate or hot cocoa can help stave off Alzheimer's and keep your brain healthy. This is the latest in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. Having 2 cups of hot cocoa each day could help prevent the cognitive decline associated with aging and Alzheimer's disease. Researchers from Harvard Medical School have stated that hot cocoa increases blood flow to the brain, particularly those areas of the brain associated with memory and cognition. It increases a neurovascular coupling, where blood flow actually changes in response to local blood activity. Quote from the study, as different areas of the brain need more energy to complete their tasks, they also need greater blood flow. This relationship, called neurovascular coupling, may play an important role in diseases such as Alzheimer's. Well, good for them, and I would add a few things to that. In fact, last evening, I had a person call in and ask a question concerning memory, a 35-year-old college student from New Jersey. And I spent about 25 minutes answering it to give them a whole understanding of how we lose our memory, what is memory, and a lot of the myths about memory. And because I've spent my entire adult life in anti-aging science, having led over 47 actual clinical studies with over 30,000 people, I've learned a few things about how to enhance. And it's not just 2 cups of cocoa a day that does it. It's the polyphenols that are in the chocolate. So therefore, you could get those polyphenols in many different ways. And it's not just the polyphenols there. Green tea will give you these polyphenols. Blueberries, pomegranates, dark cherries, purple grapes, red grapes, blue grapes, dark plums, onions. So we have a lot of different places that we can get the nutrients that will enhance the circulation of blood in our brain. Then if you allow things such as vitamin E, 400, 800 units from a whole combination of tocopherols, like alpha tocopherol, beta tocopherol, gamma tocopherol, delta tocopherol, and then ginkgo biloba, along with Siberian ginseng, and then methyl donors like DMG, dimethylglycine. These are substantially supportive of oxygenation of the blood. Now then go out there and do some power walking or biking, and that further increases circulation to the brain. And that way you can have a lot of benefit in preventing, even reversing dementia. The latest studies just in today on how fat we are as a country, according to the Center for Disease Control, quote, 1/3 of all U.S. adults are obese. Well, quote, it's a kind of confirmation of what we saw last time, that the prevalence of obesity in adults may be leveling off, end quote. No, it's not. Mind you, that's obese. That's not overweight. If you take how many Americans adults are overweight and then what percentage of them are obese, 1/3 are obese, almost 2/3 are overweight. That means that only a small fraction of Americans are actually at their normal weight. The problem is that we have no national program at all that advocates for a healthy lifestyle. I can understand why. Because if you start telling people what actually causes them to be sick, you're going to run right up against the buzzsaw of special interests, their lobbyists, the legislators they finance, the think tanks that they finance, the media that they control through their advertising. After all, take away the advertising for pharmaceutical drugs, for over-the-counter medication, for junk foods and beverages, and you've just probably eliminated 70% of all the things on television in the way of ads. So we're not going to be told the truth. And let's face it, where does the former FDA commissioner go? And where's the former head of the Center for Disease Control go? And where's the former head of the U.S. Public Health Service that oversees all government health programs go? Right into Big Pharma. So we're not going to know the truth. But the reality is that we are the fattest, sickest nation in the world per population. Here's some good news. Personal and social concerns are the real motivating factor behind organic food buyers. This is from Washington State University. And what it says is that more and more people are choosing to grow organic food or to buy organic food because they believe it is the ethical and right thing to do. In effect, it's an extension of their personal values. And you don't see organic food advertised. There's no major obvious movement, some social media, of course, but you'd have to go looking for it. But we just are now becoming aware that there is this essence within us that says, should we connect with something that's more real? And organic is known as the gold standard. So, and going green with our grocery is also there too. So that's good. More Americans are becoming more ethical in what they're buying for themselves and their family. Medically speaking, the number one killer is American iatrogenic conditions, meaning medically induced. Number two is cardiovascular disease. This is from the American Journal of Medicine, a major peer-reviewed journal, as reported in Science Daily. And it involved 23,000 subjects in the National Health and Nutrition Examination. Here's what they found. That there's a direct link between low fiber, high risk of heart disease, higher fiber, lower risk of heart disease. And it didn't matter whether it was age-based or sex-based or racially-based, ethic-based. It's just across the border. The more fiber you have, the healthier your heart is. The lower the fiber, the more at risk you are. And for a long time, we were told that we only needed about 5 grams of fiber. Well, now we know we need about 50 grams of fiber, ideally. But most people are only getting somewhere between 5 and maybe, on a good day, 35 grams. And women are generally getting 25 grams. Just not enough. And that if you get enough fiber, first you're going to help prevent colorectal cancer. You're going to help prevent diverticulitis. You're going to increase toxins being removed with bad bacteria from the intestine, and that's what you want. And you're not going to have the constipation and the pressure illnesses. So putting fiber in your diet, the easiest way of doing it is in a health drink, a smoothie, because there you can put walnuts and blueberries and any of the fruits and vegetables you want, and vitamin C. That's a great way of speeding up digestion. And then you have your meals and just have a blended drink. If you blend one drink a day, you're getting a lot of fiber, probably about 15 grams of fiber in one blended drink. And if you blended cabbage, that's an extra benefit because cabbage has a nutrient that turns off ulcers and inflammation in the stomach and the intestine. Plus, it provides you with a really good fiber. Another good nutrient that we don't consume are bilberries. Now, in England and France, yes, they have bilberries, but they also have what are called lignon berries. Lingon berries. Here's the latest on these two, bilberries and lignon berries. This is a study, quote, "We have shown that bilberry and lingonberry protect against ultraviolet-induced retinal photoreceptor cell damage by inhibiting reactive oxygen species production, regulating specific pathogens or pathways linked to reacting to stress." In lay language, and this was published in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, it means that there's antioxidants and phytonutrients in the berries, especially the bilberry, to protect your eye from oxidative stress. Now, sunlight, direct sunlight, that creates oxidative stress. Alcohol in any amount creates oxidative stress. And also smoking, oxidative stress. If you ever looked in the eyes of someone who's a smoker and drinker, they're always bloodshot. Well, that is because of broken capillaries. So by taking these two berries or their extract, you're protecting your eyes from oxidative stress. Now, another thing that you can do that can protect you is take grape seed extract. Quote, and this is from a major journal done in a major research center, the Illinois Institute of Technology, Institute for Food Safety. And here's what it says. Grape seed extract in beverages shows promise in blood pressure reduction. Two new studies both show the potential grape seed extract dispensed in capsules to help reduce blood pressure in people at risk of hypertension. And they are called polyphenolics. Now, polyphenolics, break it down, poly, multiple, phenolics, individual compounds generally found in either the seed or the skin. And this was a randomized, double-blind, 10-week study. You done also at the University of California at Davis. 300 milligrams of grapeseed extract and in a beverage. And, quote, "The big news with the beverage was the systolic blood pressure in the whole population dropped 7 mm of mercury after 6 weeks. And that was from a Dr. Friedman. And then also it increased in 10 weeks when they stopped taking grapeseed extract, so we saw a nice little rebound effect. The diastolic blood pressure of the population dropped 3.8 mm of mercury as well. Takeaway message: eat grapes, chew up the seeds, throw seeded grapes into a blender, get a grapeseed nutrient. It's going to help you. And that's just not one study. There's also another study I found from the Journal of Cell Communication and Signaling, and it found that grapeseed extract is superior to a diabetic drug in its anti-diabetic effect. How about that? Now, we know that insulin resistance is what happens when the body fails to react to the hormone insulin created to manage blood sugar levels. In response, the pancreas creates more insulin that multiplies the problem, ultimately leading to diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Well, so if you have cinnamon, that helps if you're a diabetic or pre-diabetic. And now if you have flaxseed, that helps you especially if you're type 1 diabetic. But if you have grapeseed extract, numerous benefits, but also helping you if you're diabetic, better utilizing insulin. Oh, and just so you think that this is something unusual or rare about grapeseed, it isn't. The latest study, as reported in Cancer Letters, the peer-reviewed journal, from the University of Colorado Cancer Center, grapeseed extract provides a natural treatment option for colorectal cancer. Now, we know that colorectal cancer is growing in the United States. Wonder why? How about all that meat and fried food in the American diet and alcohol? And it's just, it is a cancer that is fueled by processed convenience foods and a sedentary lifestyle. Well, colorectal cancer is the second most common cause of cancer death in the United States. 52,000 deaths attributed this year alone. What do I recommend to help? I recommend curcumin and resveratrol. They've both been proven effective in prevention of colon cancer. And now we have this new research showing that grape seed extract, what I've just been mentioning, specifically targets damaged cells in the digestive tract to provide an effective treatment for colorectal cancer. And that's great. The lead study author and doctor candidate, Molly Derry, commented, quote, "We've known for quite a while that the bioactive compounds in grape seed extract selectively target many types of cancer cells. This study shows that many of the same mutations that allowed colorectal cancer cells to metastasize and survive traditional therapies make them especially sensitive to treatment with grapeseed extract." Well, the takeaway message: grapeseed extract could provide a critical starting point to encourage the use of natural therapies to treat colon cancer and could save some lives. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're here to help people in the healing process. Now let's go over to our environmental segment. Today we have two important studies. The first one is some good news for all of you who've been fighting the enormous tens of millions of dollar campaign by the GMO companies and the grocery and manufacturer associations that want us to have genetically engineered foods and do not want us to know that the foods that we're eating have these. So here's the latest. This is from Ocean Robbins. Quote, "It hasn't been a good week for Monsanto and the rest of the biotech industry. Just 3 days ago, Mexico banned genetically engineered corn, citing the risk of imminent harm to the environment. A Mexican judge ruled that, effective immediately, no genetically engineered corn can be planted in the country. This means that companies like Monsanto will no longer be allowed to plant or sell their corn within the country's borders. At the same time, the county council for the island of Kauai passed a law that mandates farms to disclose pesticide use in the presence of genetically modified crops. The bill also requires a 500-foot buffer zone near medical facilities, schools, and homes, among other locations. And the Big Island of Hawaii County Council gave preliminary approval to a bill that prohibits open-air cultivation, propagation, development, or testing of genetically engineered crops or plants. The bill, which still needs further confirmation to become law, would also prohibit biotech companies from operating on the Big Island. But perhaps the biggest bombshell of all is now unfolding in Washington State. The mail-in ballot state voters are already weighing in on Initiative 522, which would mandate the labeling of genetically modified organisms, knowing full well that 93% of Americans support GMO labeling, and that if one state passes it, many others are likely to follow. Entrenched agribusiness interests are pulling at all the stops to try to squelch yet another state labeling effort. This time, however, things aren't going to be as planned. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed a lawsuit against the Grocery Manufacturers Association. The GM Grocery Manufacturers Association, a lobby for the junk food industry, has been by far the largest donor to efforts to defeat the labeling initiative. The lawsuit alleges that the Grocery Manufacturers Association illegally collected and spent more than $7 million while shielding the identity of its contributors. The source of the money has now been exposed, and it turns out Pepsi-Cola, Coca-Cola, Nestle's, General Mills, and a few other junk food companies. The lawsuit reveals that the Groceries Manufacturers Association leadership held a series of secret meetings to plot how to perpetrate a money laundering scheme and illegally hide member donations from Washington State voters in direct violation of campaign disclosure laws. So we are making a move. Now, here's my suggestion. Here's what I want to see people doing. We have the multi-award-winning documentary and a major article on genetically engineering of foods. The movie is called Seeds of Death. The article by Richard Gale and myself, he is one of our scholars in residence, lays out every argument that the GM industry is making. So when they say, oh, well, we'll have more of a sustainable world with genetically modified foods, no, you won't. And we go through why you won't. It'll cost more. No, it won't. It'll cost less. Every single one of the arguments they use in California to win, we have shown why, where they lie. And all they do is lie. Remember, last year's California Proposition 37 was well ahead in the polls until Monsanto and his allies spent $46 million of their campaign and that's what caused them to switch over. That's unfortunate, but that's the reality of what happens when you spend a lot of money. So here's my suggestion. I would like anyone in this audience in the state of Washington to go online, download my film, which is there as a public service. I've not charged anyone for it. And over 500,000 of the audience from the Progressive Radio Network, where we broadcast each day, downloaded it. Over 500,000. It's right there. Google Analytics. You see the numbers. 487,000. And then another site had, I think it was 200,000. And that doesn't include Dr. McCullough's site, which were millions, and Mike Adams, and it doesn't also include Life Extension. So you start looking at all the people who watch this. You're way up into the many, many millions. Good. Let's get it shown all over the state of Washington. Get it on public access. Stream it. Network it. Send it to everyone you know. Because with it, and attach the article. So with a documentary showing you the lies of the genetically modified industry, and then showing the truth of how we defeat them, and I have all the whistleblowers, everyone, is in this film. So let's help our friends in the state of Washington defeat the genetic engineering industry and all of its major corporate backers. Okay? It's up on the website. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com, download it, and share it. That's what it's for. This is a social issue cause. And finally, from the environment, from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Doug Gurian Sherman says the following. Small farms, not Monsanto, are the key to global food security. I'll quote, in the land of humongous farms, the critical importance of small farms for food security is a counterintuitive message. But if we look at what most of the largest farms are growing for the U.S., in the U.S., in the Midwest, or Argentina or Brazil, It's the same. Corn and soybeans to feed livestock and biofuel production. Neither contribute to the supplying food and especially good nutrition to the billions who cannot afford meat. Meat is a welcome part of many diets, but besides being expensive, it also is an inefficient means to produce protein. Mark Bittman, in a recent article, cites the Etc. Group, which notes that small peasant farms feed about 70% of the global population. Producing enough food is a necessary but not nearly sufficient condition for alleviating hunger. But the answer is small farms. They get more produce per acre than large farms. So here's what we have to finally acknowledge, and there are dozens of studies supporting this. Let's get back to the land. Let's start supporting local farmers, organic farmers, sustainable farmings. You could even in Brooklyn, in Washington, D.C., in Virginia, Maryland, backyards, you could put your own small hydroponic house. In cities, you could get the city to give you a block that's been abandoned and degraded, clean it out, and put in the sustainable community gardens. The small farm is what we grow real food for real people, not the mega corporate farms. So that's the takeaway message from there. On a separate note, I've been watching the talking heads on MSNBC, and they certainly are articulate, and they're intelligent, they're well-educated, and most of them have reasonable personalities. It's just that that's also true with many of the people on the right. In fact, if you ever listen to Mark Levin, he is hilarious. He is probably the funniest guy on radio. And he's very bright. He's a constitutional lawyer. But that doesn't mean that his policies or what he advocates are on the right side of where we need to be or truth. That's also true for almost everything on the left in radio, corporate left, I should say. And I want to make it very clear that when I am challenging the Clinton, Obama, Democrat, liberal, that's purely a corporate manifestation. I do support the historical Democrat, liberal, but I also support many of the historical conservative views. I believe that there's truth in both, but not in the corporate agenda. The corporate agenda is corporate driven. And they get very personable people to get on the air and tell you why we should believe in them or their candidacy or who they're defending. It's no different than Nation Magazine. Some very outstanding people have written for the Nation Magazine. But when I look for the articles supporting a third, fourth, fifth party that we need in this society and having support for Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson or Gary Johnson or any of the other dozens of people who've been more than qualified, it doesn't get there. Instead, it's the same old support the Democrat. Well, that's because the corporate Democrat people behind the magazine in different influential positions, not everyone, not all the readers, not all the writers, but you have to begin to look at where you're getting your information. So the other day when I'm watching Chris Matthews on Bill Maher, I was surprised by the lack of any sense of scholarship, accuracy, or understanding real content. There was none in their arguments. Just support Obamacare because it's the law, and if not, then somehow you're a rabid Republican. No. Let's be more realistic. I spent 1 hour in a commentary last week on the Progressive Commentary Hour, my own commentary, delineating with specific facts why I would be opposed to Obamacare, no matter what the name of it was, but why I am supportive of a universal health care and preventative medicine. If the object of the exercise is to prevent disease, we have failed. If the object of the exercise is to give better treatment for people who have disease, we have failed worse. If the object of the exercise is to prevent people from going broke, that doesn't work. And the object of the exercise is to have people live a longer life, children to be born healthier, we have failed miserably. And yet the very basis of the arguments, shouldn't health care have something to do with health? And it doesn't. according to Kate Randall, and I think we should spend some real attention on this, after years of promotion and lobbying and political wrangling, health insurance exchanges are open for business. And this is all part of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Now, under the health care overhaul, people without health insurance are mandated to purchase coverage from private insurers or face a penalty. And coverage for enrollees is set to begin January 1st, 2014. Here's what I explained. Who's behind this? It's the insurance industry. Is this the same insurance industry that has been found guilty on dozens of occasions of all forms of criminal activity and price fixing and price gouging and, yeah, same ones, that have paid hundreds of millions of dollars each in fines? Same ones. The people that if you would never want these people as a friend or a business partner or be related to them because they're serial offenders. They have no ethics. Same ones. But these are the people who were invited repeatedly to the White House for private discussions, wrote the bills themselves. Same ones. The insurance exchange launch is a milestone in a process that, in the guise of reform, has been aimed at funneling hundreds of billions of dollars into the bank accounts of the private health insurers and slashing costs for the government and corporations. So in the end, it'll leave tens of millions of Americans uninsured and others with vastly deteriorated medical services. Do you remember in his bid for the presidency, Barack Obama pledged to implement a sweeping social reform in the provision of health care in the United States? He claimed that under his plan, no insurer would be allowed to deny coverage to a sick child or an individual with a pre-existing condition. No family would go bankrupt or hungry due to health care costs, and that the insurance companies would be held to account. I remember that. I know BAI's audience remembers that. A lot of people wanted to believe that. The process now underway demonstrates that a colossal fraud has been perpetrated against the American population in the name of Obamacare. Every single promise that they set out to make were lies. Any nominally progressive feature of the legislation has been long since stripped away or abandoned. But the truth of the matter is that it was never about improving medical care for ordinary Americans, and it was always about setting up an even more heavily class-based system of health care delivery. Now, from the beginning, Obama promised that his reform would slash hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicare, and costs would be further cut by eliminating unnecessary treatments and services. Even after the bill's passage, without the much-vaulted public option, one concession after another was made to big business. Only companies with 50 or more employees would have to provide insurance. Only those working 30 hours or more had to be covered. Bare-bones, skinny plans without hospitalization and surgery coverage would be considered adequate employee-sponsored plans, and those businesses that did not comply would face minimal penalties. People without coverage through their employer or from a government program such as Medicare or Medicaid are to make up the fresh pool of captive, cash-paying customers who must, by law, fend for themselves on the insurance exchanges. Beginning just last week, those browsing the offerings on the new marketplace were confronted by a confusion of array of plans, but with one common feature. The least expensive plans offer the lowest levels of coverage with limited choices and the highest out-of-pocket cost. And while those shopping for insurance plans will be provided with minimal government stipends or none at all, there is no meaningful oversight over what the insurance companies can charge for coverage. Let me make that very clear. If an insufficient number of young, healthy people sign up, the insurers can be expected to jack up the premiums ever higher to bolster their cash flow, so there is no limit. They'll do exactly what they want, and they always have, and we know what their motive is, profit. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the health care overhaul will leave an estimated 31 million people, about a tenth of the population, uninsured by 2023. Undocumented workers and their families are barred from purchasing coverage on the exchanges, and due to a family glitch in the law, businesses are only required to further provide affordable insurance to their employees, not the employees' families. So those family members will not receive subsidies to purchase coverage on the exchanges. The very poorest people will also be ineligible in some states. While the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Affordable Care Act was constitutional, it struck down a component of the law that called for expanding Medicaid. The result is that in 21 states, many people making below the poverty level will not be eligible for the affordable subsidies or Medicaid. Still others will be forced to go without coverage because they simply cannot afford it, or without the government subsidies. The health care overhaul is affecting a shift in the insurance market as a whole. Some companies and municipalities are already planning to end coverage for retirees or active workers, dumping them on the exchanges. So others are ending the traditional employer coverage and offering workers a defined contribution to purchase coverage on private insurance exchanges set up by their employers, with limited choices and high out-of-pocket cost. One in four employers are reportedly considering moving their workers to a private exchange over the next 3 to 5 years. The health care bill is thus playing an additional insidious role, serving as a model for employers and local governments to currently provide insurance to an estimated 150 million people. Employer-sponsored insurance, since World War II, has been the traditional way workers at most companies receive coverage, is being eliminated by many employers and replaced with a voucher system. The same type of C exchange is being eyed in relation to Medicare by politicians on both parties. And they want to see a lot of this scrapped in favor of a voucher system. Those ostensible liberal Obama supporters who have long championed Obamacare as a progressive reform are still attempting to pull the wool over the eyes of an increasingly skeptical American public. The New York Times, which has campaigned relentlessly for cost-cutting in health care, headlined an editorial, said, quote, "Dawn of a Revolution in Health Care," writing the legislation, quote, "is a striking example of what the government can do to help people in trouble," end quote. Really? Where did you get up and get your brain working? This is completely untrue. And shame on the New York Times. What? Why? Why should they be ashamed? Look at all the stuff they've done wrong. It's all a pack of lies. I'm calling you out, New York Times reporters. You should be ashamed of yourself. Obama is a thoroughly revolutionary measure crafted in the interest of the type of elite, wealthy layers that populate the Times editorial staff. That is simply the truth of it. And we all know that. Decisions about medical care and the well-being of society should not be subordinated to the interests of a tiny minority who hold the rest of society hostage to profit motives. The wealth and technological means exist to establish a system that can provide universal quality health care to every American. But in this most unequal of societies, where the richest 1% now monopolize more than 22% of all household income, the ruling elite hoard their cash while millions of Americans are plunged into poverty and joblessness and underemployment, or go in uninsured. And that's the fact of it. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment with special commentary, and then we'll take a moment for TalkBack, where you have an opportunity to call in at 888-874-4888 and share your thoughts. One quick notion. When I hear these people talking about how well we're doing, no, we're not. Which of the we are you referring to? Are you referring to 8 million millionaires? Yes, doing quite well. 40 million Americans who have been rather conservative in their money management, and good for them? Yes. Are you talking about the about 1,500 billionaires? Yeah. And the super wealthy, about 5,000 who have over 100 million? Absolutely. So what you're really talking about is you're talking about around 60 million Americans, give or take, are going to do great. But that also leaves how many? 255 million Americans who are suffering. This is from Kate Randall. Quote, "Nearly half of public school children in the United States were poor in the school year that ended this year. That's from the Southern Education Foundation, the oldest U.S. education charity. In 17 states in the South and 4 in the West, children from low-income families comprise the majority in public schools. So you could say that 50% of U.S. public school children are not living up to what the standards of equality that you establish for yourself. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. There's going to be a historic program this evening at 7 p.m. It will be on the Progressive Commentary Hour. It's historic for the following reason. The highest employee of the World Bank to ever go on the record and tell the truth is going to be interviewed for 2 hours. This woman, who is a Yale top lawyer and has worked in academia, has worked in the World Bank for 20 years as a senior legal advisor, who knows everyone, including Larry Summers and Paul Wolfowitz, both of the World Bank. She's going to tell the truth, and I have some real hard questions for her. I'm going to be looking at bankers' proposal to what is called capital levy on private wealth, meaning what happened in Cyprus could happen here. I'm looking at three of the latest studies that shows quantitative easing doesn't help the economy at all, that money laundering and the drug trade, they're all the big banks, including the World Bank. Corporations now using foreign tribunals to attack domestic court rulings. You didn't know about this, but this has been going on. These are private attorneys for major corporations making decisions on behalf of international globalized companies that then cause governments to lose and have to pay. Got a whole lot. Also, Greg Palast, I'm going to be reading a secret in-game memo written by Larry Summers that established the blueprint for the takedown of the entire financial industry so it could be remade to their interest. And we thank Greg for sending this over. Greg Palast, of course, is a well-known author, investigative journalist. That's going to be on there too, so you'll see who was behind the whole conspiracy of the Glass-Steagall Act. That'll be at 7 p.m. Progressive Commentary Hour, Progressive Radio Network. You won't want to miss it. It'll be a classic show. I'm going to share, we're going to finish off here today with a commentary from Chris Hedges. It's from Truth Dig. It's called Let's Get This Class War Started. Quote, "The rich are different from us," F. Scott Fitzgerald is said to have remarked to Ernest Hemingway, to which Hemingway allegedly replied, "Yes, they have more money." The exchange, although it never actually took place, sums up a wisdom Fitzgerald had that eluded Hemingway. The rich are different. The cocoon of wealth and privilege permits the rich to turn those around them into compliant workers, hangers-on, servants, flatterers, and sycophants. Wealth breeds, as Fitzgerald illustrated in The Great Gatsby in his short story, The Rich Boy, a class of people for whom human beings are disposable commodities. Colleagues, associates, employees, kitchen staff, servants, gardeners, tutors, personal trainers, even friends and family bend to the whims of the wealthy or disappear. Once oligarchs achieve unchecked economic and political power, as they have in the United States, the citizens too become disposable. The public face of the oligarch class bears little resemblance to the private face. I, like Fitzgerald, was thrown into the embrace of the upper crust when young. I was shipped off as a scholarship student at the age of 10 to the exclusive New England boarding school. I had classmates whose fathers they rarely saw, arrived at the school in their limousines accompanied by personal photographers so that the press could be fed images of rich and famous men playing the good father roles. I spent time in the homes of the ultra-rich and powerful, watching my classmates, who were children, callously ordering around men and women who worked as their chauffeurs, cooks, nannies, and servants. When the sons and daughters of the rich get into serious trouble, there are always lawyers, publicists, and political personages to protect them. George W. Bush's life is a case study in the insidious affirmation action of the rich. The rich have a snobbish disdain for the poor. Despite well-publicized acts of philanthropy and the middle class, they actually don't like you. These lower classes are viewed as uncouth parasites, annoyances that have to be endured, at times placated and always controlled in the quest to amass more power and money. My hatred of authority, along with my loathing for the pretensions, heartlessness, and sense of entitlement of the rich, comes from my living among the privileged. It was a deeply unpleasant experience, but it exposed me to the insatiable selfishness and hedonism I learned as a boy who were my enemies. The inability to grasp the pathology of our oligarchical rulers is one of our gravest faults. We have been blinded to the depravity of our ruling elite by the relentless propaganda of public relations firms that work on behalf of corporations and the rich. Compliant politicians, clueless entertainers, and our vapid corporate-funded popular culture, which holds up the rich as leaders to emulate and assures us that through diligence and hard work we can join them, keep us from seeing the truth. They are careless people, Tom and Daisy, Fitzgerald wrote of the wealthy couple at the center of Gatsby's life. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness, or whatever it was that kept them together. Aristotle, Machiavelli, Adam Smith, all began from the premise there is a natural antagonism between the rich and the masses. Quote, those who have too much of the goods of fortune, strength and wealth, friends and the like, are neither willing nor able to submit to authority, Aristotle wrote in Politics. The evil begins at home, for when they are boys, by reason of the luxury in which they are brought up, they never learn, even at school, the habit of obedience. So said Aristotle. Oligarchs, these philosophers knew, are schooled in the manipulation, subtle and overt, of repression and exploitation to protect their wealth and power at our expense. Foremost amongst their mechanisms of control is the control of ideas. Ruling elites ensure that the established intellectual class is subservient to an ideology, in this case, free market capitalism and globalization, that justifies their greed. The ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships. Marx wrote, the dominant material relationships grasped as ideas. The blanket dissemination of the ideology of free market capitalism through the media and the purging, especially in academia, of critical voices have permitted our oligarchs to orchestrate the largest income inequality gap in the industrialized world. The top 1% in the United States owns 40% of the nation's wealth, while the bottom 80% own only 7%. As Joseph Stiglitz wrote in The Price of Inequality, for every dollar that the wealthiest 0.1% amassed in 1980, they had an additional $3 in yearly income, 2008. We Americans are not usually thought to be a submissive pool, but, of course, we are, so wrote Wendell Berry. Why else will we allow our country to be destroyed? Why else will we be rewarding its destroyers? Why else will we all, by proxy, have become giving in to the greedy corporations and corrupt politicians, participating in its destruction? In conclusion, most of us are still too sane to be this misled. But we allow ourselves to do so, and we reward those who fool us. Reward them so well, in fact, that those who do this to us are the wealthiest amongst us. How do we submit? By not being radical enough, or by not being thorough enough, which is the same thing. The rise of the oligarchical state offers a nation two routes, according to Aristotle. The impoverished masses either revolt to rectify the imbalance of wealth and power, or the oligarchs establish a brutal tyranny to which the mass is forcibly enslaved. We have chosen the second of Aristotle's options. The slow advances we made in the early 20th century through unions, government regulation, the New Deal, the courts, and alternative press and mass movements have been reversed. The oligarchs are turning us, as they did in the 19th century steel and textile factories, into disposable human beings. They are building the most pervasive security surveillance apparatus in human history to keep us submissive. This imbalance would not have disturbed most of our founding fathers. The founding fathers, largely wealthy slaveholders, feared direct democracy. They rigged our political process to thwart popular rule and protect the property rights of the native aristocracy. The masses were to be kept at bay. The Electoral College, the original power of the states to appoint senators, the disenfranchisement of women, Native Americans, African Americans, men without property, locked most people out of the democratic process at the beginning of the Republic. We had to fight for our voice. Hundreds of workers were the beginning of the Republic. We had to fight, and that we did. And so it is. Hundreds of thousands died or were wounded in labor wars. The violence dwarfed the labor battles in other industrialized nations. The democratic openings we achieved were fought for and paid for with the blood of abolitionists, African American surrogates, workers, and those in the anti-war civil rights movements. Our radical movements, repressed and ruthlessly dismantled in the name of anti-communism, were the real engines of equality and social justice. The squalor and suffering inflicted on workers by the oligarchical class in the 19th century is mirrored in the present, now that we have been stripped of protection. Dissent is once again a criminal act. The Mellons, the Rockefellers, and the Carnegies at the turn of the last century sought to create a nation of masters and serfs. The modern corporate incarnation of this 19th century oligarchical elite has created a worldwide neo-feudalism where workers across the planet toil in misery while the corporate oligarchs amass hundreds of millions in personal wealth. I'm Gary Noll, and I want to leave a few minutes here at the end of our program for you to call in and share your comments on our talkback. Our number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. We are simulcasting on our sister station WBAI, WPFW, and other stations, and as well as originating from our Progressive Radio Network. And as soon as calls come up, we will take them on. And while I'm waiting for the calls to come up, this comment from The Real Agenda: Michael Bloomberg is calling a meeting to force vaccinate under fives with two dangerous vaccines. If you thought things in the world of vaccines could get any worse, then you were wrong. Mayor Bloomberg of New York City has called for a public hearing this week, recommending that all children under the age of five whose parents want to attend daycare facilities be vaccinated with the annual flu vaccination and pneumococcal vaccines before they are accepted. According to the statement, a basis of purpose, these vaccines are needed because children serve as a major source of transmission in communities. Quote, influenza costs an estimated 200,000 hospitalizations and an average 36,000 deaths annually in the United States. And this is according to the CDC. Not only is this policy irresponsible, it's a total waste of taxpayer money, especially when there are more pressing issues. Well, first off, that figure of 36,000 deaths is wrong. In point of fact, that's for the flu. That is not that's for pneumonia, not the flu. And the CDC has hence eliminated that statistic that had on there for years. So every time you heard someone say 36,000, 36,000, it's a lie. There is no scientific basis. In fact, when I went back and I got the last 30 years of the CDC's actual statistics, they separated them out. Those that died from pneumonia and those that died from the flu. In a given year, the flu might kill anywhere from a few hundred to as many as maybe 3,000 or 4,000. So we've been lied. Secondly, the flu vaccine has never been shown effective. We have all the statistics on that. We've written multiple articles on that. Let's say hello to Michael from New York City. Hi, Michael.
Hi, yes, Gary. I was wondering, Hegel, Friedrich Hegel, he's a German.
Yes.
What was his big picture? What exactly was he trying to say in terms of all his
I'd be happy to answer that, but we only have a moment. I just wanted people to call in and make a statement. I'd be happy to. I'm fully familiar with Hegel's work, as I am with Marx's work, But let's do that one. That deserves at least top 5 or 10 minutes to explore in depth. But
okay,
right now,
you.
If you have a comment you'd like to make, I'm happy to have people call in and make a comment.
No, I'm just going to let the people who are waiting online to express their
okay.
comments. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Michael. All right. Also, my suggestion is that get a copy of any one of the seven different articles, all fully medical referenced articles, on our website. Take them to the hearing. Present them to the people at the hearing, because we show that the flu vaccine is not effective. We show that it's dangerous. We show that the science behind the flu vaccine is flawed, and we document it in detail. And you can use these. They will withstand any criticism. They have all been vetted completely for facts. That's one thing you can do. Separately, you could take a copy of The Silent Epidemic and offer that to the mayor to watch. And because clearly, after someone watches the documentary on the lack of science and efficacy and safety in vaccines, they wouldn't be promoting something like this. This is part of this whole idea that we have good science. We do not. And let's see, we'll take one last call before we sign off, saying hello to David. Hi, David.
Hi, Gary. One big suggestion. You
sure.
and Steve Brown go by WBAI and run it yourselves. That's my suggestion.
Well, WBAI is going through. First of all, thank all of you for the support you've given to the station in the last 5 days. We are averaging over $33,000 a day. Last week, we were able to pay the transponder, $50,000, which is the satellite, the rent, some back rent, and the payroll. We had been averaging only about $7,000 until there was a major push to do more fundraising. And though I'm the first to say I would love to hear a lot less of me and just reserve what I have to say for noon, at least we're raising some money. And at least we're giving people tools that they can help themselves. And most importantly, we're all doing it to help the station. So the station has had an enormous infusion of capital, and over 2,500 premiums were mailed out because of that, that would not have been mailed out. And bills paid. And it ends in one more week. Let's all be working together. And I'm looking forward to new ideas, new ideals, and really making the audience first in the future with BA.
I fear she has already decided to get rid of it. It is too late.
Well, it's never too late. Look, I'm one of those people who believe that we should be doing all we can until there's nothing more we can do. And there's still a lot more we can do, and we're doing it. So let's just one more week until we get through this drive, and then let's see how it all evolves after
Good.
That.
One
but
final
thank
question.
You for your call. Thank you.
Andrew, what happened?
We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. And don't forget, a powerful show. Wow. The highest-ranking person inside the World Bank to speak on the record and agree to take all the questions, that's unheard of. 7 o'clock tonight. Have a nice day, everyone.